Today's episode of the Gestalt Education Show is brought to you by three of our favorite sponsors, Human Locomotion, Core 360 Bell, and Dynamic Disc Designs. All the information can be found below. By now, you have definitely heard us talk about them, so check out the show notes, click the links, use the codes, and make sure you support our favorite people. As always, we got a great episode lined up for you today, and thanks for tuning in. All right, everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Gestalt Education Show. We're back at our home turf. I think this is the fourth one that we've done right here, which has been amazing. But that's why we love coming to Parker Vegas, because there's so many amazing people, and it makes our lives a little bit, you know, stressful with scheduling. So we appreciate our next guest kind of being flexible with that. But I need to introduce our next guest. So Dr. Katie Pullman. So she is the Director of Research here at Parker University. We were just talking off air. She's got a lot of balls in the air, which is amazing as far as the research coming out. And you've got a great past too of getting your PhD in Canada and then coming back to Parker. And so anyway, thank you for sitting down with us. But I think if we just maybe start off with one, what enticed you most about Parker University, and like what makes you still so excited to be working on the research, and then kind of give us a little bit of a status of the research that's happening at Parker right now.
Awesome. Well, first of all, thank you both for having me and fitting me in your set schedule. And I love being able to talk with people, because a lot of times scientists are looked at as, you know, individuals in an ivory white tower. And I would really like to be able to practice, but there's only 24 hours in a day.
Yeah.
So I'm not doing that. However, I really love making sure that my research is always applicable to those, and that you guys see that while I am four-eyed, it's that I'm approachable. I love reaching out to people. And so I forget your question already.
Tell the status of, Austin, our coffee runner, interrupted us just a little bit, but that's a good thing because we need some caffeine. But give us the status of research at Parker right now. Like what's going on? What's the status? Because Parker is leading the profession right now as far as chiropractic research.
You know what? It's really fun is that I trained at Palmer College of Chiropractic, and I can say that their research is fantastic. It's needed. When I got the opportunity to come to Parker, in trying to figure out how we can build or what we can build, I realized that I'm not going to be able to build a center like Palmer did, because there's just different opportunities that were 20 years ago. What they built with what they had then, I didn't have those. But what did I have? And what I had that Parker allowed me to dream up or go with was the international aspect of it. And so that's what I think is unique about Parker's Research Center, is that we are truly international. We work with people international, and what that allows us to do is just, there's only so much research expertise. It allows us to get all of it. Yeah. It allows us to go up to Europe and snag what they're doing and how they're doing things, go down to Australia, what they're doing, and just with all the technology and everything we have available, it is awesome.
Yeah.
And so we're really leading the way of making sure our research, we have the best of the best in whatever topic we have access to, and we have access to all of it.
Yeah, that's
and loving that.
That's amazing. And like we were talking, you've got a paper that hopefully is going to be amazing in the next couple of weeks. You hear about it, right? NIH grant is what the paper, the grant. But part of that is you were talking about the people that you were able to get on that grant, and you've been able to get on the research. And so take us through like the status of low back pain research right now. I mean, that's kind of the hot topic and the biggest thing in the industry right now.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, like low back pain is, I mean, there's so much to discover. So some people are like, can we please be done with low back pain and research? And I totally get that. But there's so much untapped information that we still need to dig into. And seeing chiropractors really embrace that, because there's nobody that handles it better than us.
Right.
Like there's so much opportunity there. So I get like there's a lot of topics we need to do. My interest itself is special populations as well as patient safety, but I greatly respect the low back pain world. So, and just to add to that, all the research that has been in low back pain, as well as much as we're like, is it done yet? It really has helped pave the way for us to explore other areas. Be like, well, in low back pain, they tried to do that and it sucks. So let's not do that step. let's go right to this. So we've learned a lot along the way. So just the appreciation of the low back pain, because of my interest in in pediatrics, it's allowed us to now dig into adolescents' low back pain. And that's the study we were talking about beforehand that I'm so excited about. Because what we know is that adolescents with low back pain are more likely to be adults with low back pain. However, we don't know anything in between there. And the whole low back pain research internationally, everywhere, nobody knows from there to there what is going on. Right. So is there ways to stop it? Is it the same people? We just know that the numbers are there. So what we would, what chiropractors, and it's awesome that it's a team of chiropractors, are leading the way in this investigation, but we're also able to bring in the best of the best scientists in low back pain. And we've built the relationship internationally that they're like, yeah, you guys should be doing this. And we'll help, we'll help be an investigator on the team. And we've built that.
Sure.
It started with a grant all from chiropractic industries. There was one in Australia. There was one, the ACA Pediatric Council supported here. The Canadian Chiropractic Research Foundation supported up in Canada. And then there were Royal College of Chiropractic in UK. So we had, it was an international study, all but collecting data from adolescents' low back pain around the world. And because of that data, we were able now to go to NIH with a full team of awesome explorers. And like, so just, again, low back pain, but it's a gap in the literature that chiropractic in another 5 years will be filling it. So
beautiful.
It's so fun.
Yeah, I love that it's leading the way, and especially with adolescents. So I know you have an interest in pediatrics and things like that. Has that always been the case? You have a big family we were talking about too. So is that kind of what led that, or what started your pediatrics?
You know, I've often you reflect as you go through. Yeah. So when I was going through chiropractic school, I don't recommend, but I did have my first child in the program because I just thought I could do everything. somebody should have.
No one warned you.
No one warned me. It's hard. And that's when I started taking pediatric extra training in pediatrics. And it was at that. So whether it was because I was having children, your interest, I don't know for sure. My sister is a pediatric nurse specialist. So I think kids are in our blood that way as well. I'm very thankful that I actually started in the pediatric world, because I can say that I've appreciated the clinical experience of the clinical experience, and then moving that into research. And I can, when I went into research, I had no idea that there wasn't evidence for the pediatric, and now to still have such a passion for it, and trying to see how we can bridge that gap and that awareness. It doesn't mean that just because it doesn't have evidence, the lack of evidence isn't the absence. It's been a long day.
Yeah. Yep.
What are the trends in pediatric back pain? I mean, has anyone looked at, like, is it discogenic? Is it spondylolisthesis? Or is it just vanilla low back pain? And that'd probably be a good place to start. It's like being able to, like, classify what.
That's exactly. So it's all the factors.
Right.
That's what we're collecting in this study and looking at it longitudinally. So collecting baseline factors and then following teens for a year.
Yeah.
Is what the study is planned to do. Just what is it? Nobody knows.
What's your hypothesis with that then? Like, what is your thoughts on mechanisms maybe, and then also what that long-term study is going to show?
I think I've known enough that my guesses are always wrong.
That's okay.
I make great charts about how I've been wrong. lots of figures. Lots of figures of how I was wrong. And so right now I'm more at a point of, like, excitement for the discovery of it. And I'm really hopeful of what I think the chiropractic profession can, hopefully we after we find the factors that how we can help with it. And I think we can. Again, I may be wrong, but if we can And then how that can impact the future, because low back pain is awful in adults. And if we can impact them at a young age and stop, you know, all the impact in the adults, that's really exciting to me. So not answering your question, but excited for the discovery of it.
Got it.
Another one of your big passions is patient safety.
Yeah.
So let's just open it up. Is it safe for our patients to get chiropractic care? How about that?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Sorry. Just kidding.
Yeah. Do not see a chiropractor, whatever you do.
No. So I always give too much information. Here we go.
Let's go.
When I went into the world of pediatrics and then I realized there was this gap, I thought, what a white flag that is, an opportunity to like embrace the literature. And so I thought that a good place to start was just to look at the safety of chiropractic care for peds. I jumped into a really deep hole.
That you're still climbing out of.
That I am still climbing out of. And it's been wonderful and like not at all the path I thought I'd have. So with that research topic interest, I really went down this road of safety and realized how much, and not just in the pediatric world, all of chiropractic care, actually all of healthcare, the impact of patient safety. In healthcare, I think we're patient safety or safety incidents or kills like one is the third leading cause of death. Like,
holy smokes!
No, it's a really big deal. Now, do I think chiropractors are a part of that? I don't. I think that's a lot of hospitals. That's a lot of pharmaceutical.
Sure.
However, do I think we're part of the healthcare team and we have an impact on that? Absolutely. And that's what excites me, is that I see chiropractors, if we can really embrace the culture of patient safety, that the changes that can make. When it comes to safety, it depends on the operational definition of safe. Are we causing, we actually just don't know. The data is difficult to establish, but the truth is that the adverse events that we're causing that's a loaded word, and I know this.
Yeah.
The adverse events that are following chiropractic care are usually mild and transient.
Yeah,
that's it. What I would like to do is I actually just learned this word this morning on a call, like hyper-personalization. Are there ways that we can mitigate some of the adverse events? Are there ways that we can start to dig in? So you guys probably know this better than me, but are there exercises we can do before or after that might reduce some of the stuff that's going on? And by collecting the data, so I'm working with the team with AI, of course, but because we need big data that AI can handle, I cannot. Right. So working with that team to collect this data so we can hyper-personalize even the mild transient stuff that we may be causing. But the patient safety culture is a bigger piece to the safety. Like, I know we're safe, but what are the other things that we could be adding to it?
And is it all physical safety stuff, or is there also like, are we looking more emotional and social things like that? I don't know if there is, or if it's mainly just physical transient symptoms.
Yeah, the other thing that we've not been able to collect in our profession is that, so the physical is what they call direct adverse events, and then it's the indirect adverse events. Like, and this is the concern in the pediatric world. So if they're coming to you, and most adverse events that are serious in the pediatric world are from an underlying condition, right? And diagnosing. And so if we don't diagnose that correctly, that's an indirect effect. And we have not been ever measured that in our profession. I think we can.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's do this.
Right.
And then what can we learn from it?
Well, especially because we always talk, we're primary care access, and therefore we need to act like a primary care physician when it comes to those types of things. And so, you know, I think that's a big passion project of Brett and I is that making sure that we're acting like doctors. And so, little things like, Brett, you do a bunch of functional medicine, so catching people with Hashimoto's and other things along those lines that I would imagine would be
absolutely
drugs in there as well. So it's not necessarily of disproving that we're safe or unsafe, but to proving that we have effectiveness to then have a culture of safety is what I
It's called safety one and safety two framework. And I'm trying to move my research to be like the safety two framework, where it's not measuring what we do bad. It's measuring what we do good.
Yeah.
We are doing so much good, but it's not documented in the way that it can and should be. That's what I'm moving toward. And then if we can document that, we can help other professions, because no healthcare profession has embraced patient safety as they should, as aviation has embraced the concept of safety. I think the chiropractic profession should be the profession other people are looking at. Like, there's no safety concerns with, or you know, people know your guys's.
Well, I think on the PR side of things, because you hear like the horrible stories, whether it's stroke or whatever it might be. And I think like, whatever we can do to find that it is safe to see a chiropractor from a PR standpoint to the public's awareness would probably be a good thing for the profession. Like in our area, it doesn't seem to be an issue, but it sounds like sometimes like in Canada and other spots where they like actually have marketing strategies that are like talking about the danger of, you know, cervical manipulation or what, you know, whatever it might be. So I feel like any research that gets done would potentially help us in that arena, maybe. Yeah.
And one of the things is, a lot of times, I mean, the only place we typically hear about stroke incidents is social media.
Right.
Right. And what you see after that is this flurry of emotional responses that are, we've been doing this 100 years. Of course, we're good. The evidence doesn't show this. But what we don't see that I would love to like shift in our profession is an, I'm sorry that happened to you. Mm-hmm. A more empathetic, that isn't, people think that's looking at like we're accepting causation, but it isn't. It's being like, I'm sorry that's happened to you. And our profession is doing everything we can to make sure that we're part of whether it was a stroke in process and that we're part of the solution. And here's what we're doing. That's what I hope, instead of like our knee jerk defensive responses, but be more empathetic. And also making sure that we're empathetic to the doctors involved.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times it's bad doctors do bad things. If I'm a good doctor, it's not going to happen to me.
Right.
Where unfortunately things can happen in everyone's office. And if we like allow a space to, let's make sure we're empathetic to all players involved.
Yeah, very true.
Because we didn't come healthcare providers for that.
Right. What are some of the barriers in research, do you think? Like, actually, Austin's enlightened us, like, some of the things that we can be doing, like, in private practice from a research standpoint. I feel like if you're, like, out in a wild in private practice, you basically don't think that you can be helping out in any way in research. So for those of us who are listening who potentially would want to get involved with research, what are some of the things, like, the, I don't know, case studies?
Starting steps.
Yeah. No, I love this. Thank you. So right now in the abstract clinical evidence booth that I have ways that you can participate. Right now I'm doing a survey. Just completed my survey. Oh, I think I've been trying to collect 50 responses for about 6 months now. I'm like, there is an opportunity. We just got ethics approval this week to collect data on safety in our pregnant women. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking for 30 offices to collect data from 15 patients. So there's opportunities like that. And I know that some of that is, you know, it will, and I'm not going to lie, like interfere with your clinical processes for a manner of time. But we talked about what is my other opportunity? There's an interest in motivational interviewing. So we're going to be recording people's conversations in offices because motivational interviewing has not been explored in our profession. And then it's just as you said, the abstracts for clinical evidence program that we run here. Practicing docs, that's exactly who it's for. And the purpose that we're hoping is that it's a first stepping stone. Like writing a case report can be intimidating, but if you can start with an abstract here, present it to your colleagues and your friends here at Vegas, as you guys did.
Yeah.
As you did. And you went through the process of making it a safe place. You receive feedback, but hopefully like it was all very
constructive,
very constructive feedback in a safe place. And then hopefully building the confidence to going the next step. And there are a few case report writing programs that I know that will be opening up here in the near future. So,
It was a good process too. I mean, Austin did a lot of work on it obviously for us, but to be able to see the feedback in the process, it was, it took time. There's no question about it. It takes time, but it's not as difficult as I thought it was. For sure, too. Good. Like reflecting on it, so I think that's a good message to send out to practicing docs. That if you have the willingness and you have some time, it's worth it to start doing. Because I assume that these are the things that ignite other research, and that's how you can kind of make an impact on where Parker puts their money towards research.
Absolutely, like you said, like I don't have a clinical practice. And I do think research questions have to come from clinical practice. There's only 24 hours in a day. When I first went into the research world, I tried to have a small practice, go to school, and I had a baby or two. I should have probably gotten rid of the baby or two, but I did drop the practice.
That's frowned upon. Getting rid of your practice is fine. Yeah. Your kids is frowned upon.
And I can say when I stopped at that point, it wasn't, I never thought that I wouldn't go back in. I didn't set out this career to be a scientist. Just can't get out of it now. A full-time gig, but making sure, that's exactly it, that I'm reading what's going on in your office. And should that be explored more, and how can we do that? Right. That's exactly it. We need to be discussing. We try to make our booth. That's one of my favorite things about this event is we bring in scientists from all over. So we have somebody from Switzerland. We have the director of research at the AECC University College so that we can all talk.
Yeah.
From an international scene. And like, yeah, we do have four eyes, most of us, but we are, you can come and talk to us and let's figure out what's going on and let's talk different opportunities that are out there, because there are out there.
As a researcher, how do you deal with like the heterogeneity of like low back pain? I mean, like there's so many different, you know, causes. And I feel like sometimes like you read research on low back pain and it's so vanilla that you almost like read it and you're like, this doesn't mean anything to me because like, it's just so bland by the time it gets published, you know? So in the future of like studying low back pain, what are some of the things that need to be done to maybe like appropriately classify the patients? That way the research actually means something to the people that are out in practice.
Yeah, right. Vanilla is very, very appropriate.
I feel like it's gotten better, but like research in general, sometimes it, by the time it gets published, it's so widespread that like you're left to think, you know, because I mean, there's research out there to show that manual therapy actually is no better than doing nothing for low back, you know, like, so, and we all know that not to be true, but like, okay, so the research is telling us that that potentially could be true. And it's because the quality of that research wasn't as good as it possibly could be.
It's one of the things, I'm going to digress again. Yep. It's one of the things when I was running clinical trials on low back pain, that's what I noticed is it wasn't the stories that I was hearing from clinical practice and what we're getting. But the thing with clinical trials is they are different patients. The patients that are coming in for a clinical trial can help tell a story.
Right.
But what's going on in y'all's offices are the story, is the story, right? So there's a time, I love clinical trials. I love them. I love putting the logistics together to get it done. But I also know the limitations of them, which is why I go for the harder piece of collecting data from offices. Like, it is a lot easier to put in a clinical trial because that's where you're getting more the real story.
Yeah.
The heterogeneity question, I mean, low back pain is difficult, isn't it?
I know.
Right? I would much rather be with my numbers than low back pain. So hopefully my numbers help you all deal with your patients. But I do think that's where the power of AI is coming in, because we need bigger data. So what the call I was on this morning, what I'm trying to do is find a way to collect the data from EHRs, and we all know the complexities of that, and all the different EHRs out there, so that I can have a database to start to like identify risk factors and prognostic factors that actually like mean something to your individual patient, not the clinical trial patient.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
So,
What about like meta-analysis and like those type of studies? Is there, where does that rank as far as like the, I don't know, the hierarchy of research.
Yeah, absolutely.
So again, meta-analysis are fantastic. But what they're doing is taking a whole bunch of clinical trials and putting them together. So every clinical trial still has its limitations of the patients that are going to come in for a clinical trial, which it is most of the time middle-aged, white, overweight males. Which is a portion of our population, but it doesn't speak to everything. But so it's just compiling a lot of those studies together. One of the studies, and it's actually how I got to meet Dr. Morgan before I came to Parker University, was the largest military study that ever was done. Christine Gertz, at that time, it was the largest funds ever given to a chiropractic research. And it was looking at low back pain in the military. What was amazing about that study was that we knew we weren't going to get what every other trial was getting. And that was, we're not going to be getting our middle-aged, overweight white males. You know, we were going to get fit, younger individuals. And how does that impact? And that was one of the powerful things about that study that came out. And it did show it was very positive for chiropractic. So it was chiropractic plus usual care versus just usual care alone. But it was the first trial that we did at Dr. Morgan's site when he was at Walter Reed. And so him and I already had a relationship. And then I was already at Parker when he came. But it was really awesome that we already had this trusting relationship and research he knew. So that was great. But that was the neat part about that study. So if we're compiling in meta-analysis study with diversity of patients, then it's helped. But most of the time, it's still just clinical trials on the same type of people. So it does give us more than just one study, but it's still clinical trials.
Right.
It's still limited.
If that. They are doing a lot more research now, instead of just the aggregate of the study. So like one study has a number here and a number here and a number here, just taking those three numbers, they're able to get the patient individual from each of those data sets. And so I know like our military study, we've been able to give the individual data. And that when we start to analyze that, that's when we get to like, let's talk about like, you know, weight, let's talk about gender, let's talk about other risk factors that again, makes it less vanilla
right.
and more like, okay, it's your patient. How is your patient going to respond?
Yeah.
Based on these categories.
Yeah, it's really good. What about, can you just speak on maybe the future of Parker Research, period? Like what things are you hoping to accomplish in your time here? And just a follow-up question on that is like, what needs to happen for chiropractic research to really turn the corner to make it more mainstream?
Love all of that. Okay, so starting with Parker University. So I love my team, and we have a range of diversity. So one, we are a non brick and mortar individual, which has some there's pros and cons to everything, but it allows me to bring in scientists that don't have the capacity to move. I can work with their brain when they're up in Calgary because that's where one of my employees are, and then Tucson and. I make sure we have a range of topics. And so we have neuroscience and human performance, and then patient centeredness, or the individual up in Calgary. He had a practice for 20 years, and that was something our team was missing because I've had a practice, but not really. And I'm like, we need that clinical experience. And then his work was in patient centeredness. I'm like, that's exactly what we need, like real stuff.
Sorry to interrupt this episode, guys. Hope you're enjoying it. Real quick, we have an amazing, amazing opportunity. The DNS World Congress is coming to Chesterfield, Missouri this June 14th through the 16th, 2024. If you guys attended our NDS or our Neurodynamics Congress, you know that this is something that's very close to Brett and I's heart, something that we are going to keep doing and keep doing and keep doing. So this year's Congress is all about DNS, dynamic neuromuscular stabilization. This is literally like looking into the ocean, as Brett says. This is the lens that we look through each and every one of our patients with. And this is going to be an amazing opportunity because Pavel is back in town. So the originator, the creator of DNS, Pavel Kolash, is coming to the States for the first time in 5 or 6 years. I don't even know how long it's been. He's bringing along with him Elena Kobosova, which is literally the backbone of DNS. She's one of the most underrated neurologists in the world. So we're super excited to hear from her. Marcella Safarova, if you haven't heard her speak, she is literally the queen of pediatrics and musculoskeletal health. We also are going to have almost every single UNS instructor at the Congress who's going to be speaking. It's going to include demos, lectures, hands-on. We're going to have, as always, a get-together afterwards with your chance to talk to these guys face-to-face and have a couple drinks with them. This is going to be a great, great opportunity. There's also, it's a great price too, especially for students. It's only $4.99. So be sure to use the code DNSstudent to get your discount on that. For more information or if you have questions, go to gestaltedu.com/DNS-Congress. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
I've been able to build a team so far that's really, I think, we can approach a vast range of topics, which also allows me, like when I write a paper from my field, I can send it to somebody else who might speak a different language and, they see so many different things.
Right.
If we were all on the same topic and the same trained in the same area, you get the same thing. And so bringing in the diversity of training and diversity of topic, I think makes us all better and perspective. And then how can we keep growing? And it's exactly what you guys are doing. Bring like showing that without we're real people and trying part of the profession, part of the team. We're team players. Mm-hmm. I never thought I wanted to be behind a desk all day. Like I wanted to become a chiropractor. Like I went to chiropractic school to, you know, like, take care of patients. I love people. And so I'm hoping that I'm still impacting people in patient care.
Absolutely.
I'm still part of y'all's team versus just in a different manner because I have this crazy skill set that I'm like, oh, that's what that's
used for.
What
do you think, Katie, evidence-based practice actually means? So like, you know, that's kind of a buzzword in our world. So like, what does that actually mean to somebody who's out in private practice? Because I kind of like the term evidence-informed because that way you're also able to like, you know, lean back on your past experiences and practice that combined with what is coming in the research, but then like this evidence-based circle, if you will, sometimes they're tough because I feel like if you just listen to them, then like you wouldn't think anything that you're doing is actually working. Yeah. So how do you reconcile those thoughts?
Crawl in a hole and cry. That's the truth, right? And so this is one of the things I've tried to like as a scientist, like I know every healthcare profession, like nothing they do or everything they do is not evidence informed or evidence based. Like you just can't, there's not enough. And so it's trying to get that bigger picture of how can we make the biggest impact or understand so we can help more patients. The thing I think that is the most difficult is just being honest with patients, is, you know, like, here's what we're going to do. Here's the evidence on it. Here's what we don't know, and here's why. Mm-hmm. What do you want to do? And I think patients will respond to that better than you know, essentially lying, or you know, like. But I think you guys are all in a very tricky spot that I actually I think about a lot, and I haven't quite like answered is. The amazing thing about doctors and any doctor we all go to is you guys like provide them hope. Like they're coming to you because they want care. So, how do you portray like, here's what I know, here's what we don't know, but yet still building on their hope, because the number one predictor of success in any care so far that are in low back pain. Is expectations. If a patient expects their pain to get better, they do. That's the only predictor we have right now.
We might have talked about that yesterday. Yeah, no, that's huge.
It's huge. And so that's always been my challenge.
We call it reassurance. Reassurance that they're in the right spot.
Yeah. So how do you do that while still being honest about the evidence?
Right.
Is something I can say I haven't like embraced, and I appreciate clinicians like the challenge that you all have. Of that balance. But I think it's being one, knowing there's so many people, especially in this because I was there in the pediatric world that says things that are false, mm-hmm. that just actually tear us down versus add to us. Where so you can say, you know, like this is the clinical experience that's out there. This is where it's added evidence wise and just being okay with that and being transparent with it.
The pediatric patient is a special population is interesting because you're basically taking away the power of suggestion kind of, you know, like I think kids would be less likely for the placebo to be at play. I'm sure it is at some point, but I mean, I think that's like in research, what's really hard to kind of like differentiate and separate is what is what you were just talking about. Like just the thought of that you're at some place that's there to help you, you're already getting better versus what you're actually doing to get the patient better. And then honestly, does it even matter? I mean, like if the patient's better and they're not taking narcotics and they're not having surgery, then that's got to be considered a win. But like for those of us, you know, that are dying to know, like what's what in that world, you know, and I feel like the pediatric patient, they may be a perfect one to kind of help us sort of separate that because of that maybe, I don't know.
This is why I love talking to clinicians. That's brilliant. Well, we know most, unfortunately in pediatric, most research comes from the parents. And what we know is proxy reporting from parents is actually, they report their kids' pain less than what their kids report. Is that fascinating?
That's great.
I would have thought the opposite.
I know. And this is why we like, yes, wrong there again. But most of the outcome measures when it comes to patient centeredness actually are parent reported. So it doesn't take that away. Let's see how we can do with that.
Well, then the other thing too is like, I mean, obviously we talked about low back pain, but like, I don't know, manipulation for dysmenorrhea, otitis media, for nocturnal urea. I mean, like all these things that we loosely kind of think are helping. Are you afraid to go there? Or is that like not in the research world? Is that like too obscure to be looking into? Or is that something that you wouldn't be afraid to look into?
I wouldn't be afraid to look into it. The problem is recruitment.
Right.
So otitis media, I was all over it. And there's a narrative review out there that I wrote quite a few years ago, and not another study has been done since then. The recruitment of patients into a study for otitis media, as a parent, it is difficult. That's the game changer. Mm-hmm. And so if I was a parent and I wanted chiropractic care for my otitis media child, I'm not going into a clinical trial.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. That's the limitation of it. And so that's as much, again, as I like experimental studies and the randomized controlled trial and how great that data clearly answers questions. Observational data is where we need to go, where we need to spend more time is collecting from an observational standpoint.
Or it's hard, like the Bronfert report clearly showed that like manipulation doesn't help that much for asthmatics. However, you have asthmatics show up at your office all the time swearing that you're helping them. So sometimes like the treatment is indirectly helping their condition, although it's not like a direct fix to that condition. Therefore, the research is a little bit skewed maybe on...
Yeah. What are the outcome measures that he used?
Right.
And I do think it's quality of life that we're impacting when it's people with these conditions.
Yeah.
I would not say we can treat autism, mm-hmm. but the quality of life that I hear from my pediatric colleagues, like just the less headbanging mm-hmm. that they might do, that's huge for quality of life. Those are the things I think
right.
can impact. But to get the numbers needed to look at that, that's the difficult part. And the money it would take versus we know there's a lot of low back pain patients with adolescents. Mm-hmm. I can take money and do a study in 2 years with that, right. where I can take the same number and 10 years later, I might have data. That's what stops research being done in those areas is the amount of time it's going to take to recruit and the money.
Yeah.
What's the easiest way for someone who's like out in private practice to, you know, keep up with research? Because everybody's telling us, you got to keep up with research. But like besides Twitter and Instagram, do you have like a go-to, like does Parker have something that you guys are like churning out for people, or is it?
We don't, because there are a lot of services out there.
Yes, you don't want to compete with that.
Yeah. Austin, do you, and then why compete when there are great. Austin, were you there? Sorry. Were you there when I did a, I do a thing for students once a term. And one time I brought in four different individuals that have different services. They were all offering it for free to the students. And I was like, get to know, like, I'm not one of them, like, this is better than this one. It's whatever, we are like things a little bit different, like get to know those services and then use them. Because there are, I mean, that's something we didn't have 5-10 years ago, is these people that can, and I know these individuals and they're doing a great job of breaking it down, but I was like, as a student, like, do it while it's free.
Right. Yeah,
sorry. Yeah. Not all of us are there anymore, but yep. do it while it's free so that you know, and then you can go out there and then you can pay for it afterwards. It's just paying and looking at all the different services, but there are a handful of really solid services breaking down the literature.
Sean Thistle's one. He does good. Yeah.
RRS.
Sean Thistle. Cairo Up.
Oh, Cairo Up.
Yep. Cairo Up. Yep.
Yep. Twitter. Following the right people.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Yep.
X, Twitter, whatever the hell it's called.
Yeah, you're right.
I love it. Love it. Yeah, I think that's the most difficult thing is one, keeping up with it, and then two, like applying it. I think that's what is always a difficult thing. So that's what it makes me excited that you're thinking about the clinical side of things a little bit more, which is amazing, or want to kind of bring that approach. And so I think that that's the difficult thing, right, Brett? Like to read a research article and then for it to change your paradigm.
Yeah, because how often are you scrolling through your thing, looking at research, you read the research, but it doesn't change what you're about to do in a second, because in the back of your mind, you're like, nah, I don't. And that's not the right attitude.
Right.
So anyways, we actually talked with Austin. That's one of his jobs in our office, is to take research and actually have it like plugged into like our model and like where it fits. And then like be able to put like not our spin on it, but like that. Do you know what I'm trying to ask? It's kind of so like if you just paid attention to every piece of research that you saw on social media today, I mean, that would be insane. Yeah. So like very rarely does anybody read something and be like, okay, this is going to change what I'm going to do tomorrow. Although everybody who's reading this is in this evidence-based world, myself included. So I just think that's kind of a interesting dichotomy, really. That's
fascinating.
So yeah, why that's what the topic of your talk you got coming up. Yeah, you read research, but it doesn't necessarily change. It's not a call to action to actually change what you're doing.
So I think I have two perspectives on that. One is just like from my patient safety work. And so I don't think I alluded to this, but I'm just going to do a shout out because I want people to know about it. So with WFC, they started a global patient safety initiative, of which I have the honor to chair. And so with that research, I don't expect it to change your practice tomorrow. What I hope it does is change policy and perspective of our profession that allows patients to open the door. So you being aware and or supportive of initiatives like that, that's, I think, important for the profession.
So it's a small step to the...
Yeah, so I think a lot of research are more going to be impacting the policies and the procedures than necessarily what happens in your day-to-day office.
That's fair.
Which can affect reimbursement. It can affect like lots of things downstream. Not necessarily the clinical side of things, which is
And just my goal is always to open more doors for patients to have access to chiropractic care, from whatever perspective that is, that they can get into your door,
right?
Because I know they need our care.
Right.
So how can I provide the
that's a good mission.
It's a great mission. I think that's the part of research that we don't necessarily think about too. We want to have the clinical side. We want to have reimbursement go higher, but to actually drive those changes, policy has to happen too. So
There's times that I know I get people don't like to hear what I have to say, and I don't actually like to hear what I have to say. I would like to say it differently, but don't kill the messenger. Like this is where we're at times, but being truthful. While it's not what you want to hear for your practice, it does add trust and transparency to other healthcare policies. Yeah. If you're willing to say, we don't know the evidence on that, actually.
Yeah.
And that opens, I hope, more doors, even though it can make people very angry.
Yeah. Right.
That's just part of life, though. I mean, come on. If you're not ruffling a little bit of feathers, then what's the point?
If you're not pissing off 10% of the room, then you're not.
Yeah.
You're not anybody.
That's exactly right.
And that's part of it is looking at the research, being willing to look at the research that maybe challenges how you do things.
Yeah.
Like, instead of just like, that's not how it is in my office, challenge it. Like, is that because of the patients that they got into whatever study? Or is it because your patient population is different? Or is it something else? But being willing to like check yourself to not just be like, well, that's not my belief. And so I think that's a healthy place to be too.
Love it. As we wrap up, Austin, I know you you worked a lot with Dr. Pullman. Do you have any other questions or any shout outs or anything for her?
I mean, Dr. Pullman was one of my big mentors in chiropractic school and helped open the door for me for getting involved with research. So she is a giant in our profession from a research standpoint, and I'm thankful to have her in my corner, and I'm glad we got her on the podcast to shed some of her insight in this world. And I look forward to doing some stuff from the clinical side and staying involved with Parkway Research moving forward. So awesome. Thank you for coming on, Dr. Bowman.
It, you know, like that's how my doors were open, is people were willing to like I mean, I was as green as they get, and just challenge and help me think and help me grow. And so just giving that back, and it, you know, she like, just somebody like, oh, he wants to talk to me. Was so exciting because we need the next generation. Awesome. So I'm always excited to talk to the next generation and thankful. So
Thomas Shout always talks about like when you get a hold of someone and does a paper, like these people just like basically live in a cave. So when you reach out to them, it's like their family. Like they're just so excited that somebody reached out to them that they'll do. They're more than happy to like tell you about their paper and things like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly right. We'll give a little one more encouragement for our guests that are in clinical practice to participate in the ACE, to submit a poster, to start tracking some case studies, things like that. And then what's the best place to get a hold of you or to kind of follow your work and things like that?
Yeah. I wish I could say I'm active on I'm there. Active depends on what kid is breaking what at what time. But the best, kpullman@parker.edu, send an email. Sometimes, as Austin knows, it might take me a couple days to respond, but I get there. I will get there. Eventually. And so if you have questions, comments, concerns, but come see us at Parker Seminars, at our ACE booth, the ACE program. It's really there to like create an environment where you can see new research, talk to scientists, and evolve. So thank you.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Love well it. Done.
Yeah. Well I'm sure we're going to keep submitting posters every year, and that'll be part of our little thing is, once you did it once, now we can do it again and again and again. So, thank you very much for sitting down with us, Dr. Pullman. Thank you for your efforts, on the front lines of research and, for making it more clinical. We love that stuff. So, yep. But anyway, guys, keep reading research and, good luck with patients. We'll see you next time. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Gestalt Education Show. If you liked it, share it, subscribe to it, send it to your friends, send it to someone that needs to hear this message. We really want everyone to be able to tune in and get the best clinical advice that they can, which we're hoping that we're giving to you with these special guests. So if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to us, or if you have any suggestions on upcoming conversations, let us know. For a list of our upcoming courses, we're adding them all the dang time. So go to gestaltedu.com, click on courses, and they'll all be right there for you. All right, have a good day.